minivan had twisted inward on itself, so nothing would open. Mrs. Edith Mitchell covered her face with her hands. The unstoppable soldier that hatched out from Travis Pope sat up front, watching the two frightened humans in back while he chewed and chewed at Ollie Jungfrau. Kelsey Creek Bridge is a good spot for walleye fishing. The Vice President of the United States of America once caught an 11-pound walleye in the Allegheny Reservoir in Pennsylvania. One female walleye can lay 500,000 eggs during a spawn. Travis Pope made shit all over the front seats. Then Travis Pope climbed out through the van's shattered windshield and scampered off into the Iowa night, sniffing the air, looking for Eileen Pope. The Vice President of the United States of America was asleep. He dozed off after receiving a blowjob. Blowjobs always made the Vice President drowsy. The Vice President of the United States of America was scheduled to fly to Germany early the following morning to visit in the afternoon with American soldiers who had been wounded in Afghanistan. The Vice President's wife, who has no formal title, was having a glass of Scotch whiskey. And at that exact moment, Wiggles, Mrs. Edith Mitchell's wayward blue Maine Coon cat, came back home looking for food. Concerning the bison and free will. Later, after Robbie and I left Eden, I came to a sudden realization about history. Here is what I concluded. All this time, I have been devoting too much thought to the guys who painted the bison on the wall of the cave, and too little attention to the bison itself. I mean, the bison is the important member of the team, isn't he? But once the historians put the thing on the wall, it was almost as though every bison for all eternity became doomed to face the hunter's interminable slaughter. We killed this big hairy thing, and this big hairy thing, and that was our day. You know what I mean. I began to consider the fact that maybe history is actually the great destroyer of free will. After all, if what we blindly believe about history is true, the old cliche admonishing us to learn how not to repeat the same shit over and over again, then why do the same shitty things keep happening and happening and happening? I felt guilty for ever having written anything at all about me, about Robbie or Shan, Johnny McKeon, Pastor Roland Duff, Unstoppable Corn, St. Casimir's, Kreese Sturba, contained MI Plague Strain 412E, Unze Sturba, Herman Weinbach, a talking European starling named Baby, Felix Sturba, Phoebe Hildebrandt, Eva Nightingale, my brother Eric, and two prostitutes named Tiffany and Rhonda, whom we met on the third floor balcony at a hotel in Nashville, Tennessee. Each of us became a bison on the wall of my own cave. Pavi Seppinen, Julio Arguelles, everyone on every road that crossed beneath the point of my pen was always going to do the same things over and over and over. I was confused. How could I be in love with a girl and a boy at the same time? I was trapped forever. You know what I mean. Population explosion. Welcome to Eden. Please secure the hatch upon entry. The repeating message finally stopped. Whoever had joined Robbie and me in Eden closed the hatch after they came inside. But it was no 6-foot-tall praying mantis army of spike-armed killers. Nor was it some crazed hermit McKeon Industries unstoppable scientist. Our new arrivals in Eden were Shan Collins, her stepfather Johnny McKeon, and her mother Wendy McKeon. Johnny McKeon was carrying the biggest handgun I had ever seen. Johnny McKeon Smith & Wesson 500 Magnum was made in Massachusetts. A bullet fired from the pistol travels at nearly 2,000 feet per second. I wonder if Johnny kills queers, Robbie whispered. I said. Johnny McKeon did not come down into Eden to kill Robbie Breeze and me. Shan and her family had come down to Eden because they knew the unstoppable soldiers were running wild in Ealing, Iowa. Robbie and I stood in the doorway to the locker room. Ingrid, never one to get too worked up about such things as late-night visitors, sat on the floor between us and yawned. To Johnny McKeon and his wife, Robbie Breeze and I must have looked like players in a science fiction movie, dressed as we were in our matching and numbered Eden Project jumpsuits. Shan Collins, who now officially hated me and Robbie Breeze, avoided my eyes when I tried to look at her. Welcome to Eden, Johnny, I said. I think you were safe down here. Johnny McKeon said. Johnny McKeon was pale and shaken. He looked at the gun in his hand, then back at me with an apologetic expression like Johnny McKeon wasn't aware that a gun the size of a small bazooka had somehow attached itself to the palm of his right hand. You can't shoot them anyway, I said.
I know that, Austin, Johnny McKeon said.
And then Johnny asked,
Are you okay?
I caught Shan's eye. Shan Collins had been looking at my face. She turned pale and immediately lowered her gaze. Shan Collins was confused. She was in love with the Polish kid who was also confused. I said, "Yes, we are okay, Johnny." Johnny McKeon walked across the floor of the mudroom and placed his Smith & Wesson 500 Magnum on the bench just below the scientist's old windbreaker that had been hanging from a hook on the wall for nearly half a century. I said, "I suppose it's time for me and Robbie to show you what has been going on." Shan coughed nervously. "You know what I mean." Everything a guy could need, and the two best rock albums ever made. We were the new humans. Johnny McKeon, Shan Collins, and her mother Wendy Collins McKeon changed into Eden Project jumpsuits and white scientist socks. Robbie and I did not stay in the locker room and watch them change their clothes. Things were weird enough without doing shit like that. When the newest new humans joined us in the lecture hall, I pointed out the chalkboard diagram of the development from 412E, the unstoppable corn mold, to the creatures Johnny McKeon had seen fucking and eating earlier that evening in the alley at Grasshopper Jungle. Although we suspected it, Robbie and I did not know for certain that there were several more unstoppable soldiers up above us in Ealing until we heard it from Johnny McKeon. Up until that moment, Robbie and I had only seen one unstoppable soldier, the one that came out of Hungry Jack. Despite that, we did believe the Hoover boys and Grant Wallace had to have hatched out as well. Johnny McKeon also confirmed the unstoppable soldiers were spawning. Robbie Breeze and I had watched all five reels of Eden orientation series. We knew the world had less than 24 hours before every human being on the planet dropped to a lower level on the food chain. It was not a good level to be on. Rob, I said, "you still against the paintball idea?" Robbie said, "Eh." Johnny McKeon drank scotch, and Wendy made herself a vodka gimlet at Eden's Tally Ho, which was the nicest bar in a 30-mile radius for this part of Iowa. Things would be better for Johnny and Wendy McKeon if they were drunk. Robbie Breeze reached across the bar and nonchalantly grabbed the bottle of scotch whiskey and poured some out into two glasses. Nobody said anything about it. Robbie said, "Tally ho!" Robbie Breeze and I drank the scotch whiskey. It tasted like hot cinnamon and dried fruit. Johnny McKeon said, "The scotch must be 60 years old." Johnny McKeon appreciated good scotch whiskey. "It is like drinking history," I said. Johnny said, "Cheers." Robbie Breeze and I got drunk with Johnny McKeon and Shan Collins' mom in Eden. It only took two small glasses of scotch whiskey to make me feel like everything was funny, and I wanted to dance with Robbie Breeze again. We lit cigarettes. Wendy McKeon might have known Robbie and I smoked cigarettes, but we had never done it in front of her. She was distant and unaffected by what was going on. Johnny and Shan must have scared the shit out of her with the stories about what they knew was happening in Ealing, and Johnny and Shan didn't know half of it. Wendy McKeon was very pretty. Her breasts were tight and sharp beneath the shimmering fabric of her jumpsuit. I wanted to touch them. Wendy McKeon was Eden 93. Johnny McKeon was Eden 7. Wendy McKeon's hair was the color of ground coriander. I fantasized that somebody would suggest we all have an orgy when we got to the parts of the film where Dr. Grady McKeon commanded us to breed. The scotch whiskey made me feel very horny and confused. I would be the first one to volunteer to strip naked out of my clothes, but Johnny McKeon kind of made me feel nervous. I could not imagine Johnny McKeon ever having sexual intercourse with Wendy Collins McKeon. Johnny McKeon was the only person in Eden I did not want to take a shower with at that exact moment. I realized I was getting a scotch whiskey-fueled erection. I did not believe anyone would approve of my erection at that moment. So I sat at the bar and asked Robbie for another cigarette. Robbie knew what I was thinking. He always did.
"Tally-ho, porcupine," Robbie said.
Robbie Breeze was drunk. He lit a cigarette for me and passed it to me. The filter end was just a little bit wet with Robbie's spit.
"I'll be danged if they don't have everything you'd ever need down in this place," Johnny McKeon said.
Johnny McKeon got up from the bar stool. He threw a dart at the board that hung on the other side of the pool table.
"I'll be double danged," Johnny said daringly.
"A proper Eden will always have everything a guy could ever need or want, Johnny," I said.
"That, and the two best rock albums ever made in the history of humankind," Robbie added.
The Blood of God. We took Johnny McKeon and his family on a tour of the silo. We did not show them the entire Eden orientation series. Johnny McKeon only wanted to see a portion of the final film. He wanted his wife to know what the creatures he saw at Grasshopper Jungle looked like. It did not matter. You could not watch 5 minutes of Eden orientation series and not witness some experiment with sperm or shit like that.
or hear Dr. Grady McKeon telling us that it was our duty to start having sex.
My big brother was a nutcase, Johnny McKeon concluded.
Isn't there television down here?
Winnie McKeon asked.
Maybe there would be something on the news about what's going on.
It was a good question. The lack of televisions did not register with me until Wendy McKeon asked about it. We hadn't seen one television set in Eden. I imagined Dr. Grady McKeon concluded that when the Eden Project became a necessary sanctuary for humanity, there would be nothing at all worth watching on any broadcast stations. New humans would be without commercial television. Maybe there was hope after all. Dr. Grady McKeon was probably correct about post-apocalyptic television broadcasts, although we eventually did find a bank of 5 side-by-side televisions that night in Eden's brain room. Here is what happened. We were all very tired after watching the final few moments of corn eating and three-legged race running in Reel 5. Shan would neither speak to me nor sit near me inside Eden's theater. I thought Johnny McKeon or Wendy might have seen Shan's behavior as cold or unexpected, but if they did, I could not tell. I began to think guilty thoughts that maybe Shan had said something to her parents about me. I was confused and frustrated, and I desperately wanted to have an opportunity to speak to Shan. Robbie Breeze and I were also drunk. The Scotch whiskey made us brave and reckless. I admitted to Johnny McKeon that we had come up with a plan to kill the unstoppable soldiers, a plan involving Robbie Breeze's blood and the paintball guns that had been stored inside my garage ever since my brother Eric went away to join the Marines and have his testicles blown off. Robbie announced that if he could have one more drink of Scotch whiskey, he would let me take blood from him. It was all a very ghastly proposition. I did not think I could actually do something like stick a needle into Robbie Breeze's arm. The thought of inflicting pain on Robbie nearly made me cry. With everything that had been going on in my life that past week, and now with Shan treating me like an enemy, I was an emotional disaster. Shan's mother, Wendy McKeon, had been a registered nurse before marrying Johnny McKeon and moving to Ealing. She said if she could have one more vodka gimlet, she would draw a few vials of blood from Robbie Breeze. I went pale. Robbie went pale. It was all very ghastly. The clinic filled with the steaming smell of alcohol breath. There is something about the sterility of clinics that repels everything, as though they are vacuums unto themselves, like the glass globes into which the McKeon scientists trapped all kinds of shit. As soon as the 5 of us entered the Eden Project clinic, the place absorbed the odors of booze, sweat, cigarettes, and golden retriever. I have B.O., I said. Ingrid sighed and curled up on the floor beneath the flat, padded examination table. St. Casimir's brought a dead girl back to life, and he also made a blind boy see, I said. I unzipped the top of my jumpsuit and slipped the silver chain over my head. I told Robbie he should wear the St. Casimir's medal while Wendy McKeon drew blood from him. I put my chain on Robbie. He looked scared. Wendy McKeon told Robbie to lie down on the table and strip to his waist. Wendy began opening cupboards and drawers in the clinic, gathering the things she would use to collect blood from Robbie Breeze. Robbie undid the top of his jumpsuit and slid it down around his hips. He lay there, half naked, on the operating table. I wonder if those McKeon sickos ever operated on teenagers here, I said. Robbie said, I touched the St. Casimir's medal and pressed it against Robbie's heart. Wendy put 2 wadded balls of gauze into Robbie's palm and told him to squeeze them. I bet that's the first time you ever squeezed someone else's balls in a doctor's office, I joked. Robbie said, shut up, Austin. Okay, I agreed. Shan was exasperated. She said, I can't watch this. Shan thud-thudded in her padded scientist socks out into the hallway. I wanted to follow her, but I was stuck. I could not just leave Robbie alone in the clinic. I looked back and forth, from the door to Robbie's pale chest as Wendy McKeon tightened a rubber tube around my best friend's bicep. Robbie gripped the wads of gauze in his hand. He was scared. I didn't want to see Robbie Breeze scared and hurt. Robbie's skin was the color of the insides of sweet Babcock peaches. He knew what I was thinking. Robbie Breeze whispered, you should go talk to her, Porcupine. Robbie Breeze always knew what was going on. I wanted to ask Ingrid what was I going to do, but I did not want Johnny McKeon and Shan's mom to think I was an insane kid who talked to his non-barking dog and shit like that. I said. Wendy McKeon stabbed a thick needle right into the bend of Robbie's arm.
Gee whiz, babe, Johnny McKeon said.
Thick maroon blood began filling up the cylinder on the syringe. Blub, blub went Robbie's blood. Robbie winced. I felt my knees buckle.
I better step outside, I said.
Wanda Mae's pink bowling ball. Shan Collins had gone down to the end of the hallway. She stood outside the doorway to Eden's bowling alley. Shan faced away from me, but I could tell she was crying. I felt like shit. "Please don't cry, Shan," I said. I put my hand on her shoulder and slid it up beneath the soft, warm fluffs of her perfect hair. She did not pull away from me. That was progress, I thought. History is all about progress. "And please don't hate Robbie. Or me. I would never lie to you, Shan. I love you too much," I said. "And, be honest. How many boys do you know who actually have the ability to save the entire world? Robbie Breeze is like a superhero." Shan laughed and cried at the same time. History does show that Shan Collins was a complex person, capable of doing such things simultaneously. All my best friends were very complex.
"Why didn't you ever tell me, Austin?" Shan said.
I nearly gave Shan Collins the automated teenage boy response, which would have been, "I don't know." I stopped myself. "Do you really want to hear about Robbie? Because I will tell you everything I know about him, Shan," I said. Shan said,
"No."
I said, "I love you, Shan Collins." She wiped at her face. It was my fault Shan was crying.
"Tell me the truth. Are you gay, Austin?"
Shan Collins said. "I really don't think so. I don't know, Shan," I said. "Maybe there is something wrong with me."
"But I love you, Austin," Shan said.
"I know that. I'm sorry for hurting you, Shan," I said. "I can't even begin to tell you how much I love you." Then Shan turned around and put her arms around me. We kissed, more deeply and passionately than we had ever kissed in our lives. I pressed my hips into hers. She did not back away from me at all. Shan Collins clearly approved of my erection. She said,
"I'm scared, Austin."
I whispered, "I guess I am too."
"Okay."
"I'm sorry." We moved like tangled dancers through the doorway and into the bowling alley. That was a lot of progress. The world was turning, and mankind was marching onward, doing the same stupid shit over and over and over. I unzipped Shan Collins' jumpsuit and did the same to mine, so I could press my bare chest against her full breasts. My throat tightened. My heart felt like it was squirming up inside my neck, just like a fat walleye forcing its way through a shallow creek during the spring spawn. Eden 5 needed to spawn. We went deeper into the bowling alley. I imagined being inside a cave, 15,000 years in the past. Shan Collins and I threw off all our clothing. Naked, we went down onto the floor together.
"Do you think this is the end of the world, Austin?"
"We'll be okay. We'll be okay." Shan kissed me. She put her mouth everywhere on my body. It was electric. But I could not stop myself from thinking about my brother, Eric, and the two prostitutes named Tiffany and Rhonda. I thought about St. Casimir's and his hair shirt, about Chris Sturba and all the Sturba men after him. I thought about Robbie in the clinic. I thought about naming my balls. Shan Collins helped me put my penis inside her vagina, and we had sexual intercourse right there on the floor of Eden's bowling alley, below a pair of shoes and a pink ball that had Wanda May embossed in gold on it. Our sex was noisy and urgent and wet. I rubbed my kneecaps raw, scraping them on the rough carpeting at the shoe-changing station. I pushed Shan along on her butt until her head and mine bumped against the rattling rack of bowling shoes. I did not care about anything at that exact moment. No one knew anything about it. Dr. Grady McKeon would be proud of Shan Collins and me. We were unstoppable. At exactly that moment, Lewis, the cook from the pancake house, whose real name was Ah Wong Sing, climbed over the bloody, shitty mess in the front seat of Ollie Jungfrau's Dodge Caravan minivan. He got out of the van through the shattered window, the same way the unstoppable soldier that once had been Travis Pope did. Ah Wong Sing wanted to help Mrs. Edith Mitchell get out too.
"Climb over the seat," he said to her.
Mrs. Edith Mitchell shook her head and said no. Ah Wong Sing tried all the doors on the Dodge Caravan. He could not open any of them.
"Climb over the front seat," Ah Wong Sing repeated.
But Mrs. Edith Mitchell would not move. Ah Wong Sing said he would get somebody to help. He ran off, across the Kelsey Creek Bridge toward Amelia Jinx Bloomer Park, which was the opposite direction from where he had seen the unstoppable soldier going. Ah Wong Sing was smart. Mrs. Edith Mitchell waited in the crumpled Dodge Caravan minivan. It was not a good idea. At exactly that moment, Robbie Breeze was lying back, dizzy. Robbie stared up at the soft fluorescent lights inside the clinic while Wendy McKeon smoothed a plastic bandage across the small dark hole she had left in Robbie's arm.
Just lie there for a few minutes, Wendy McKeon told him.
Then Wendy McKeon put the three large syringes she had filled with Robbie Breeze's blood inside a small steel clinical refrigerator. Johnny McKeon was asleep on a wheeled doctor's chair with the back of his head propped against the wall. In the bowling alley, Shan Collins and I hurried to put our clothes on. We were both sticky and smeared all over with semen and saliva. I wanted to take a shower. Neither of us said a word. I was more confused than ever. I felt terrible for all the things I had selfishly done to Shan and Robbie. I shut my eyes and asked St. Casimir's to help me. Outside, I heard Wendy McKeon calling for us in the hallway. I stuttered guiltily, offering something shitty about bowling a few frames when I saw Robbie Breeze, Ingrid, and Shan's parents looking for us in the hallway. I do not lie, and now I was a liar too. Shan and I were mortified with embarrassment. Robbie's mouth tightened in a disappointed frown. He looked drained and tired. Robbie knew what we did. He could tell. Robbie Breeze always knew everything about me. Robbie Breeze slipped my silver chain over his head and handed the medallion with St. Casimir's back to me. Robbie said,
"Thanks for this, Austin. You probably need it more than me now."
A cigarette was what I needed, but I did not have the guts to say anything to Robbie Breeze. I looked at Ingrid and said, "What am I going to do, Ingrid?" Ingrid yawned, which is what Ingrid always does when she is confused. I was confused too. Johnny McKeon said,
"Dang, a dog who understands English. Ain't that a kick?"
Rules are rules, but the brain room is not particularly brainy. Johnny McKeon did not have to try very hard to convince me and Robbie that we should wait until daylight before going back to my house for the paintball guns. Robbie Breeze and I were going to use my paintball guns and Robbie's blood to kill the unstoppable soldiers and save the world. Nobody wants to go out in the dark with unstoppable soldiers on the loose, even if you happen to be hanging around with their god, who is armed with a paintball gun, or shit like that. I hoped the god of unstoppable soldiers was not too upset with me for sneaking away while his blood was being drained, so I could have sexual intercourse with Shan Collins on the floor of a bowling alley. Unlike my great-grandfather, Unze Sturba, I was not testing myself or trying to prove anything. That was what I told myself, at least. I was probably wrong. I mumbled something about wanting to take a shower. I stunk. Wendy McKeon said that if we had to stay in Eden for a while, we would have to make some kind of rules about when boys could shower and when girls could shower. It was a ridiculous thing to make a rule about. Wendy McKeon may just as well have made a rule about the rotational speed of the Earth. History shows that as long as there have been human beings on this planet, once you put two of them together, rulemaking will start up before you know it. I sometimes take showers with Ingrid, I confessed. Ingrid yawned. We made this stupid rule and this stupid rule. Boys are not allowed to love each other. Then we painted a bison on the wall. I wanted to take a shower. I was sticky and scratchy between my legs. I felt like the abrasive acrylic carpet fibers from the bowling alley were boring into my balls. I had BO, and I needed to pee really bad. Everyone else wanted to go to sleep. It was very awkward and nerve-wracking for me, talking about going to bed. I wanted Shan and Robbie to sleep in the same room with me. I wanted to hold them both and tell them how sorry I was. I knew that would not happen. You know, rules and shit like that. It was on our way through the hallway of Eden's dorms that we discovered the brain room. Here is how we discovered it. The door had a brass plaque with etched banker font letters that said this: Brain Room. Robbie, Shan, and I did not notice it before when we were running crazy through the sleeping compartments, jumping on beds, and not making rules, and shit like that.
What the heck?
Johnny McKeon said.
Maybe it's some kind of command post,
Wendy, Johnny's wife, offered. I said. After watching and listening to Dr. Grady McKeon for about 3.5 hours tonight, I would not be surprised if the room on the other side of this door was filled with actual brains. Or sperm, Robbie added. I said. I turned red. Shan was absolutely silent. Nobody wanted to hear about sperm at that exact moment. But Robbie was actually closer to winning the Guess What Is Inside the Brain Room game. It turned out there was quite a bit of sperm inside the brain room. Robbie Breeze, the god of all unstoppable soldiers, pushed his way between Johnny McKeon and me. Robbie turned the knob on the door. We went inside Dr. Grady McKeon's brain room. To be more precise, we went into the receptionist's office of the brain room. Dr. Grady McKeon kept a secretary. History will verify that his secretary was highly involved in Dr. Grady McKeon's mission to breed. Dr. Grady McKeon attempted to breed with his secretary on top of her desk, on the floor of the reception area, on the pool table in Eden's tally-ho, and even on the stainless steel tray caddy in the cafeteria. Dr. Grady McKeon's sperm was not very lively. Dr. Grady McKeon's sperm was not unstoppable. In fact, Dr. Grady McKeon's sperm never got started. Dr. Grady McKeon's secretary's name was Wanda Mae Rutkowski. She had a nameplate on her desk that said so. Moments earlier, Shan Collins and I had sexual intercourse below Wanda Mae Rutkowski's pink bowling ball and tricolor bowling shoes. Wanda Mae Rutkowski had feet like Godzilla. While my penis was inside Shan Collins' vagina, I noticed that Wanda Mae Rutkowski's shoes were women's size 11. It is my job to notice accurate details, no matter what is going on. Wanda Mae Rutkowski's desk was frozen in time. "Hey, gum," I said. Wanda Mae Rutkowski left an opened pale green rectangular package of Wrigley's Double Mint gum on her desk. There were three sticks left inside the pack. I took one and began chewing it. The texture at first was cardboard-like and somewhat disappointing, but there was still a remarkable double mintiness locked within the sugary gum. "Unstoppable chewing gum," I said. Robbie said, I prayed to St. Casimir's that he would see to it my balls would not dissolve. Wanda Mae Rutkowski also had a pack of cigarettes called Virginia Slims. I wanted to smoke one of them. There were two cigarette butts in an ashtray that came from Clements Motor Inn in Cedar Rapids. Wanda Mae Rutkowski had cotton candy lipstick. It made me horny thinking about Wanda Mae's lips. My penis was a real dynamo. I finally settled on names for my balls. My balls deserved names. The Virginia Slims cigarettes were menthol and very thin. They looked like candy. Wanda Mae Rutkowski obviously enjoyed minty pleasures. A rotary dial phone sat on her desk, too. Like the others we had seen in Eden, it had a row of clear plastic buttons across its base. Never look for ice cream in a sperm freezer.
"Well, I'll be a monkey's uncle," Johnny McKeon said.
I never knew what that meant, but in Dr. Grady McKeon's case, it would have to mean that someone's sperm got inside a monkey. Ingrid yawned. Johnny McKeon picked up the handset for the phone.
"I haven't seen one of these beauties in a coon's age."
In the wild, North American raccoons live approximately 3 years. Double mint gum was invented in 1914. Chris Sturba was 26 years old in 1914. I stuck my stale double mint chewing gum under Wanda Mae Rutkowski's desk. Johnny McKeon dialed Ollie Jungfrau's phone number. Ollie Jungfrau could not answer his phone at the Del Vista Arms because Ollie Jungfrau had been eaten by Travis Pope on the Kelsey Creek Bridge. It didn't matter, because the brain room's phone did not connect to phones on the surface of the planet Earth.
"This is only an internal line, I guess," Johnny McKeon said.
"Who would you call after the end of the world anyway?" "Satan's Pizza does not deliver in the event of global cataclysm," I said, adding, "It says so right at the bottom of the placemat menus."
"I never noticed that,"
Johnny McKeon, who had absolutely no sense of humor, said. Satan's Pizza would no longer be delivering because Stan, the owner, whose real name was Sebastian Hernandez, had his head removed by Travis Pope's crushing mandibles earlier that evening. On the wall behind Wanda Mae Rutkowski's desk hovered the sun-like golden shield of McKeon Industries' Infinita Frumenta seal. On either side of the seal hung black and white framed photographs of Dr. Grady McKeon with President Richard M. Nixon, Vice President Spiro T. Agnew, and CIA Director Richard Helms. There were two other photographs hanging on the wall. The first was a photograph of a man named James Arness, who was a television star in a program about the Wild West. The second was a photograph of Dr. Grady McKeon standing with Pope Paul VI. The inscription on James Arness's photograph said, "To Grady, thanks for the corn." The Pope wrote a message across his picture in blue ink. "Dear Grady, this corn is sublime." Dr. Grady McKeon dissolved the Pope's balls. Excrementum sanctum. Below the great seal of McKeon Industries was a small brass plate that read, "Sperm Vault. In Eden, mankind is unstoppable." The seal was actually a door cover to Dr. Grady McKeon's bank of frozen sperm. Robbie opened the seal door. Behind the door was a heavy steel freezer.
"They have the president's sperm in there," Robbie said.
I said, "they have the Pope's sperm in there."
"And James Arness's," Johnny McKeon added.
"Oh my," Wendy McKeon said.
James Arness was a handsome man.
Handsome.
My favorite actor, too,
Johnny McKeon offered.
Maybe there's some ice cream in there, Robbie suggested.
I repeated. I pushed the great seal shut. Let's not look for ice cream in a sperm freezer, Rob. To the side of Wanda Mae Rutkowski's desk was a windowless door marked Private. It led to Dr. Grady McKeon's brain room. A real concrete Iowa thinker. Two heads, with four gaping eyes, sat on Dr. Grady McKeon's desk, staring directly at us when Robbie opened the door marked private. Shan gasped. Wendy squeaked. Johnny McKeon said,
"Ain't that a kick?"
There were two identical grimacing lemur masks inside the brain room. They were the first things we noticed, simply because they looked like severed monster heads resting atop Dr. Grady McKeon's desk, poised to defend the room against intruders. They were exact matches to the one Robbie and I took from the roof of Grasshopper Jungle, only these were cleaner and appeared to be brand new.
Grady McKeon must have owned the world's finest collection of grimacing lemur masks and sperm, Robbie theorized.
Holy shit, I said.
I wonder if they make your face stink, Robbie said.
Shan finally spoke. She was not looking at the grimacing lemur masks. She stared in shocked wonder at the cases along the wall behind her dead step-uncle's desk.
What is this stuff? Shan said.
Johnny McKeon sighed and leaned against his brother's desk. Johnny said,
It looks like the same boatload of oddities McKeon Industries had delivered to the store when they packed up and closed down the plant.
Robbie and I tried to play dumb. Johnny McKeon never found out that Robbie Breeze and I had been inside his office at From Attic to Cellar Consignment Store the night Grant Wallace and the Hoover Boys broke in and robbed Tipsy Cricket Liquors. We were not about to tell him either. I said,
What is it, Johnny?
And Robbie said,
Huh?
Here is what we found inside the brain room. There were 10 perfect globes of pulsating black contained MI plague strain 412E, more than one for every continent on Earth, enough to ensure the annihilation of the entire human species. And all along the other shelves sat rows of bottles and bottles of deformed, clay-like body parts that had been cultivated from Dr. Grady McKeon's inadequate sperm in the Human Replication Unit labs. I noticed a foot inside one of the polymer electric cells. It sprouted long nails that grew all the way to the glass barrier, and its toes twitched, which made faint tick-tick, tick-tick sounds against the jar. And there were oblong cases that contained some of the segmented parts of the first unstoppable soldiers that had been dissolved with Dr. Grady McKeon's own blood. It was a deranged carnival sideshow. Against one of the brain room's walls was a bank of 5 television sets. The televisions were absolutely useless, as primitive as kerosene lanterns. Each of them had a numbered dial that went from channel 2 to 13. Johnny McKeon explained to me, Shan, and Robbie that at one time, televisions had to be calibrated and tuned by hand. Johnny McKeon told us that people stopped having so many children in Iowa after the invention of the remote control. Johnny said when he was a kid in Iowa, there were only 5 channels broadcasting, and that none of them was on the air 24 hours per day. Wow, I said. Did they have programs instructing you on how to paint bisons on your walls? Johnny said,
I don't think they had any art classes on TV in those days, Austin.
Johnny McKeon was a real concrete Iowa thinker. Johnny turned on one of the televisions. It took the picture tube nearly a minute to light up. There was nothing but monochromatic electric sandpaper on every one of the ratchet knob channels Johnny McKeon clicked through.
This is a real beauty, Johnny said.
Oh, I said.
It sure is,
Robbie agreed. The real prize of the brain room was Dr. Grady McKeon's personal logbook. The logbook looked like it had been written by a 7-year-old with a dull pencil. Dr. Grady McKeon's scientific record included undiluted details of every time Dr. Grady McKeon masturbated for one of his experiments or engaged in coitus with other Eden Project volunteers. In the frenetic scrawl of a crazed disciple of unstoppability, Dr. Grady McKeon also confessed to flushing Pope Paul VI's sperm down his nightingale. The other contributors' samples soon followed. Dr. Grady McKeon saw himself as the future king of a new universe. Too bad his sperm never worked for anything. But the logbook also provided relevant pieces of information about the upside-down universe of McKeon Industries Labs. It says here, I said, flipping through the book, that the lemur masks are detection devices that cause people to glow bright red if they are contaminated with the 412E.
That's crackerjack science right there, Johnny said.
Scotch whiskey made Johnny McKeon talkative and enthusiastic, even at the end of the world.
Robbie slipped one of the masks over his face and looked around at each of us.
Red balls, he said.
What? I said. I cupped my hands over my balls.
On the wall. All the balls look red, Robbie said, pointing to the globes of 412E. But we are all a boring shade of blue.
I remembered how, the night I slipped away on my mother's blue kayaks in Robbie Breeze's bedroom at the Del Vista Arms, when I put his lemur mask on my face, it made Robbie appear to turn blue. I would not say that it was a boring shade, however. Robbie Breeze could never be a boring blue.
And the best part is, Robbie continued, this one does not make my face stink.
Nighttime in Eden. Shan Collins, her mother Wendy McKeon, and stepfather Johnny all stayed in one room together. We said goodnight in the hallway. I tried to catch Shan's eye, but she was nervous and shy. Not like Shan at all. We should not have had sexual intercourse. It was an unstoppable mistake. History will show that teenagers are unstoppable horny dynamos once the jumpsuits come off. I knew that well enough after living through the week when the world ended in Ealing, Iowa. The Collins McKeons slipped into their rooms and shut the door. Then Robbie quietly said goodnight to me and went inside one of the rooms by himself. Hey, I said. Robbie did not want to talk to me. What am I going to do, Ingrid? I did not know what to do. Everything was a mess. I was in love with my two best friends, and I was making them both miserable at the same time. And there were big horny bugs up above us that were eating the whole planet. I walked away from the dormitory rooms, carrying Dr. Grady McKeon's logbook. Ingrid followed me into the locker room. Ingrid lay on the tile floor and watched me while I took a shower. Afterward, I put my boxers on and dropped my jumpsuit into the Eden Laundrette. I sat on the washing machine while it ran, and I remembered how Robbie Breeze had told me the Ealing Coin Wash Laundrette was like a vacation in Hawaii compared to the Del Vista Arms' laundry room. I left my Eden 5 jumpsuit there, tumbling and tumbling in the dryer, then found my way into my own lonely sleeping compartment, which happened to be the messy one, the room where Robbie, Shan, and I had jumped on the beds. I sighed and sat down. I wrote until I fell asleep with the lights on. Tucked inside Dr. Grady McKeon's personal logbook, I found a 1971 brochure that featured Cypress Gardens' water ski team and a creased glossy photograph of Wanda Mae Rutkowski. Wanda Mae Rutkowski was the very image of the 200-foot-tall woman on the Great Seal of McKeon Industries. At the bottom of the picture, a message that had nothing to do with corn or sperm had been scrawled in smeared blue ink and curling candy sweet script. It said, Grady, I hope you can someday forgive me. We will always have Eden. Wanda Mae. In her photograph, Wanda Mae Rutkowski is wearing knee-high lemon-yellow vinyl boots. Although people in the 1970s did not recycle plastics, those boots could likely have been converted into at least 3 complete shower curtains, perhaps a full-size slip and slide, or one of those inflatable bouncy houses parents rent for their kid's birthday. Her dress, low-cut to showcase the perfect V separating her breasts, has long belled sleeves and the wild floral print in pinks and violets. Wanda Mae is wearing a matching headband that spans her forehead from eyebrows to hairline. The hem on the dress barely covers her panties, which I imagine would be a pale lavender. Her hair falls in loose globular curls over her shoulders. It is the color of tangerine marmalade, and Wanda Mae's flawless skin looks like home-churned Indiana butter. I can't be certain, but I believe Dr. Grady McKeon did not hire Wanda Mae Rutkowski for her stenographic abilities. Wanda Mae Rutkowski performed in a barefoot water ski show in Florida throughout the 1970s, after Dr. Grady McKeon sealed up his subterranean sexual pleasure dome in Ealing, Iowa for the last time. Dr. Grady McKeon became a recluse in his old historic house when Wanda Mae Rutkowski left him. Wanda Mae married a dog trainer who made a fortune racing greyhounds in Florida. The dog trainer's name was Jan Woyner. Jan Woyner learned everything he knew about dogs from his grandfather Bruno, who survived the Great Depression by performing with circus dogs in California. Unstoppable dogs. Wanda Mae Woyner won the Women's National Barefoot Water Ski Championship, which was held in Waco, Texas in 1978. In 1978, Pope Paul VI died without ever knowing that Dr. Grady McKeon had unceremoniously discarded his sperm in my great-great-grandfather's urinal. In 1978, McKeon Industries presented 4 sealed globes of contained MI plague strain 412E to the United States Department of Defense. Nobody knew anything about it. In his abandonment, Dr. Grady McKeon, who had gone about as far off the deep end as anyone could go following the gruesome disasters of his unstoppable soldier experiments, got crazier and crazier. He forgot all about Unstoppable Soldiers and his Eden project. In 1978, Dr. Grady McKeon bought a small palace in Costa Rica and boarded up the old McKeon house in Ealing, Iowa. I could only find evidence of one recorded trip he made back to Ealing to attend a shareholders meeting, which happened when Robbie Breeze and I were in seventh grade. It was not a good time to fly. The finale of SEAM. It is the strangest machine. Pencil and paper. Paint and wall. Medium, surface, and man. The machine stitches all roads into one. Weaves every life together. Everything. All good books are about everything, abbreviated. The final lines of the opening stanza of my favorite poem are these. Let B be finale of SEAM. The only emperor is the emperor of ice cream. By the time Kreese Sterba was a middle-aged man, he had grown tired of struggling and feeling so isolated from his identity in the United States of America. Kreese Sterba could never stop being the Polish boy who lost his father on the crossing to America. Every day, Kreese Sterba could shut his eyes and see the gray, wooden body of his father as it slipped into the cold water of the slate sea. Kreese Sterba's son, Unze, had gone away to Iowa City. Kreese Sterba never knew anything about how much his son loved Hermann Weinbach. Kreese knew something about his grandson, a boy named Felik, which means lucky. But Kreese Sterba had never seen the child, nor the mother, a butcher's daughter named Phoebe Hildebrandt. Eva Nightingale, Kreese's wife, and the inspiration for his Nightingale urinal, was killed by a street trolley in St. Louis in 1936, when Kreese was 48 years old. Things like that happened all the time, and nobody knew anything about it. Without the creamy white pillows of Eva's body to enfold him at night, Kreese Sterba became cold. Kreese Sterba froze inside. Kreese Sterba still had brothers and sisters in Poland whom he had not seen since 1905, when Theodore Roosevelt was president. In 1937, Kreese left the United States to return to Poland. It was not a good idea. In September 1939, Kreese Sterba was killed as he walked in a marching column of refugees along a muddy farm road in western Poland. In September 1939, Germany was unstoppable, and Russia shared in the spoils of Polish conquest. Nobody needed Polish boys. Too bad for Poland. Too bad for boys like me. This was just one of those things in history that gave us Polish boys sleepy bags under our watchful eyes. We see everything. It is our job to pay attention to details. Wanda Mae Rutkowski had size 11 feet. One day I will go to Poland. I will ask Robbie Breeze to go to Poland with me. I know I will find the same country road where Kreese Sterba died, and I will bring flowers in last month's newspaper and place them there. With my finger, I will draw the image of a bison in the dirt. And Robbie Breeze and I will smoke cigarettes, and I will tell him all the stories I know about everything. This is the truth. The sunshine bores the daylights out of me. I decided on Orville and Wilbur, I said. Robbie said, huh? My balls, I said. I have decided to name my balls Orville and Wilbur. I named my balls after the Wright brothers. Orville and Wilbur Wright were from Ohio, though Wilbur was born in Indiana. They invented an airplane. Orville and Wilbur Wright never married anyone in their entire lives. They must have masturbated a lot, which, according to Pastor Roland Duff, would have made them highly stoppable soldiers. Maybe they wore hair shirts.
Which one's which? Robbie said.
Wilbur Wright did not have a mustache and was bald on top. So Wilbur is on the left, I answered. The left side is, kind of bald.
That makes sense, Robbie decided.
Robbie Breeze nodded appreciatively and took a long drag from his cigarette. We drove in Robbie's old Ford Explorer, away from the McKeon house, which was the only house on Ealing, Iowa's Registry of Historic Homes. It was morning, and it was time for Robbie Breeze and me to go kill some monsters. I wore my fresh laundered Eden 5 jumpsuit. It smelled like detergent and brand new underwear. We had Ingrid, 3 syringes full of Robbie Breeze's blood, 6 packs of cigarettes from the free Eden vending machines, and the 2 grimacing lemur masks with us. Robbie looked like he slept well. He had showered and his hair was wet. Robbie looked good. Robbie always looked good. Robbie said,
I am relieved to announce we are safe from committing the worst imaginable social blunder, which is giving your balls the same names as another guy in the same town's balls.
I am thankful for that, I said. I took a drag from my cigarette. Robbie said,
My balls are named Mick and Keith.
Those are probably the best names anyone has ever given their balls in the history of naming your balls, I said. Robbie said, thank you, Austin. He pushed a cassette into the tape player on the Explorer's dashboard. It was Exile on Main Street. That cassette was so old, all the printing had completely worn off it. Robbie knew the difference between Exile on Main Street and Let It Bleed only because of the smudge patterns on the plastic shell casings. The first song on Exile on Main Street is called Rocks Off. Some of the lyrics go like this. The sunshine bores the daylights out of me. Sometimes I understood Robbie Breeze better than other times. I knew he was mad at me for leaving him there in the clinic the night before, even if he selflessly encouraged me to do it. That was Robbie, and I loved him. I believed Robbie was jealous of Shan Collins. And, looking at the sky and all the light, I also agreed that the sunshine was boring. I wished we could go back underground and be alone in the dayless and nightless world of Eden, so we could play music and dance together. Just me, Robbie, and Shan. And Ingrid, too. Ingrid does not dance or bark. I have tried to dance with Ingrid. It makes her nervous. We headed off toward the town of Ealing, in the direction of my house. After that, who could possibly know? It wasn't like there were any specific instructions on how to hunt down and kill wild, unstoppable soldiers. Even the lunatics who ran the labs at McKeon Industries only had to deal with bugs in a jar, so to speak. The state of Iowa is a pretty big jar. Johnny McKeon urged us to take his gun. We did not. Despite being Iowa boys, neither Robbie nor I had ever fired a real gun in our lives. I was afraid one of us would accidentally kill the other. That would be worse than being eaten by an unstoppable soldier. Paintballs are just paintballs, unless they're filled with the blood of your god, and you are an unstoppable soldier. But a Smith & Wesson 500 Magnum could bring down a helicopter. So we left Johnny McKeon's Smith & Wesson 500 Magnum in Eden. Johnny McKeon made a sling from two Eden Project jumpsuits, and I carried Ingrid up the ladder with me and Robbie when we left the silo. Johnny offered to come with us, but I convinced him the unstoppable soldiers would leave Robbie, and hopefully me, alone. Johnny McKeon knew he did not want to leave Shan and Wendy by themselves anyway. He was just doing the Iowa Rite thing by offering us his gun and company. Iowa Rite is the same thing as blue plaid on your boxers. Johnny McKeon was a humorless but good man. That morning, we had eaten breakfast in the Eden cafeteria. Wendy McKeon cooked pancakes and brewed coffee. I did not sleep well. Neither did Shan. Her eyes were red and her hair was uncombed. It was a look I had never seen before. Shan Collins looked nervous. She looked like Ingrid when I danced with her. Shan and I managed to have a few moments alone that morning while Robbie showered and Johnny McKeon visited the toilet. It was awkward and embarrassing. We held hands, but it somehow was not like the us we used to be. Are you okay? I asked. Shan said,
I suppose so. Are you?
Nobody from Iowa ever says, I suppose so. My knees are scuffed up, I admitted. It made me feel horny to think about my knees.
I never did that with anyone before, Shan said.
I did not know what to say. What could I say? Was I supposed to apologize or something? I said, I thought it was amazing. The best thing ever. I love you so much, Shan. Did you like it, Shan?
It hurt, Shan said. And you told me you would use a condom.
That was an unfair thing for Shan to say to me. It was cold, too. We never talked about condoms or anything the night before at our little end-of-the-world party. We just did it because it was what we wanted, the one thing we needed to do. But Shan sounded like someone at a butcher shop rejecting a cut of meat for having too much fat, or shit like that. I must have left my condoms in my other jumpsuit, Shan, I said. Shan was angry. She was sorry for what we did. I felt like shit. Ingrid was happy to get out of Eden. She shit for a solid 10 minutes. Edens are made for humans, not for animals. And Dr. Grady McKeon was no Noah. Noah would not have flushed the Pope's sperm down a urinal, not to mention James Arness's. What am I going to do, Robbie? Robbie drove with both hands on the wheel, a cigarette angled daringly from his lips. He looked cool, like a tough guy in a movie, or maybe someone who was about to save the world, but had to think things over first. I mean, what if the world was not worth saving after all? What if, in some twisted way, Dr. Grady McKeon really had the right idea about starting over in a well-stocked Eden with stacks and stacks of blank books just waiting to be filled up by new humans, writing a new history, where we did not do the same shitty things over and over and over?
Why do you want me to tell you what to do, Austin? I have a tough enough time figuring out what I'm going to do,
Robbie said. Robbie was right. I am sorry for what I did last night, Rob, I said.
Why do you have to apologize to me for anything?
Robbie said. You know, I said. I had sexual intercourse with Shan Collins in the bowling alley while you were lying in the clinic having your blood taken out so we, you, could save the world.
The bowling alley sounds like a romantic spot for you and Shan Collins to have sexual intercourse,
Robbie said. Eh, I said.
It's not like I would have traded places with you,
Robbie offered.
Naturally,
that made me think again about having a threesome with Shan and Robbie. Normally, the thought would make me feel very horny. Too bad Shan Collins did not seem to like me anymore. Too bad Robbie Breeze did not seem to like me very much either. I reached back and stroked Ingrid's fur. I did not like myself, but at least Ingrid did. Dogs are good for that kind of shit. We drove along Kelsey Creek. The largest walleye ever caught in Kelsey Creek weighed 6 pounds, 4 ounces. Looking across to the opposite bank, I noticed the streets of Ealing that surrounded Amelia Jenks Bloomer Park were completely deserted. Ealing had become even more of a ghost town than it usually was. Fat, twisting columns of smoke coiled upward into the morning sky. Homes and buildings were burning. War had come to Iowa. Robbie and I both saw it. We knew what was going on. It was unstoppable. I feel like shit, I said.
Was it good? Did you like having sexual intercourse in the bowling alley with Shan Collins?
Robbie asked. He glanced at me with an inspector's no-bullshit appraisal. He shook another cigarette out and tossed the pack across the center console, onto my lap. I lit one and passed the lighter over to Robbie Breeze. I guess so, I said. I skinned my knees on the carpet.
I have heard that can happen.
You have to be careful with that indoor-outdoor shit they made in the 70s, Robbie said.
It's like sandpaper on naked knees when you're trying to put your penis inside someone.
Robbie was really smart about carpet burns and sex and shit like that. I took a deep drag from my cigarette. It was a brand called Benson & Hedges. The name made me feel rich or something. A name like Benson & Hedges says I spend a lot of money on my cigarettes. So, I am sorry, Rob, I said. Robbie shrugged.
They have a name for guys like you know, Austin?
Bisexual? I guessed. I did not think I was bisexual. I was only guessing. I was always only guessing. I was trying to talk to Robbie and make him not think about things like me betraying my friends, hurting their feelings. But Robbie Breeze was too smart for that shit.
No, Robbie said. The word is selfish. You don't really care about me or Shan.
I slumped down in my seat and stared at the columns of smoke across the creek. It was like bombs had been dropped, and the biggest one just landed on my chest. Robbie turned right to cross the Kelsey Creek Bridge. He stopped the car. I was not looking. I was not looking because I felt like I was going to start crying or shit if Robbie said one more thing to me. Robbie Breeze said,
Holy shit.
The right kind of cigarettes to smoke just before you kill something. Ollie Jungfrau's Dodge Caravan minivan sat crumpled against the steel trusses of the Kelsey Creek Bridge. The nose of the van was folded in on itself, as though it had run head-on into an unbendable pole. The front wheels sat in a stew of antifreeze, transmission fluid, and motor oil. There was blood, too. The windshield had been caved in, and dripping smears of blood streaked everywhere. Over the shelf of the van's dashboard, the steering wheel, and both front seats. I slipped one of the grimacing lemur masks over my head. Robbie said. I wanted to see if any red lights would show up. I wanted to hide my face from Robbie Breeze. Ingrid did not like the mask. If she were a normal dog, Ingrid would have barked at me. Do not get out of the car, Robbie, I said from inside my mask. Robbie said,
That's Ollie Jungfrau's van.
I did not say anything. Of course I knew whose van it was. Robbie inched the Ford Explorer slowly past the wrecked vehicle. I smoked. The mouth of the grimacing lemur mask served as a kind of cigarette holder. I could easily wedge the filter end of my Benson & Hedges cigarette tightly between two of the grimacing lemur's lower teeth. It was very convenient.
Robbie said, What if smoking a cigarette in that mask messes up your sperm, Austin?
I did not care if my sperm got messed up. I wanted my sperm to get messed up. I did not say anything to Robbie. I kept smoking with the mask on. Robbie stopped the Explorer and slipped the second mask over his head. He smoked, too. And Robbie said,
I'm sorry if I hurt your feelings, Austin.
It's okay, I said. You are right, Robbie. I deserved it. I deserve to have messed up sperm.
Nobody deserves messed up sperm,
Robbie said. he drove around Ollie Jungfrau's ruined Dodge Caravan minivan. Unfortunately, at exactly that moment, Mrs. Edith Mitchell woke up. Mrs. Edith Mitchell was still hiding in the back seat of Ollie Jungfrau's Dodge Caravan. She had fallen asleep, wedged down between the seats and the floorboard of the van. When she poked her head up to see if she was being rescued, what Mrs. Edith Mitchell saw drove her beyond the brink of her sanity. What she saw were two monsters with rat-like heads in blue and white jumpsuits driving a Ford Explorer while they smoked cigarettes. Mrs. Edith Mitchell thought Ollie Jungfrau was correct, that aliens from outer space had landed in Iowa, for whatever reason. Mrs. Edith Mitchell believed the end of the world had come to Ealing, Iowa. She was probably correct. Robbie Breeze and I did not see Mrs. Edith Mitchell looking out at us through the dark rear windows of the crumpled Dodge Caravan. As we passed, Mrs. Edith Mitchell finally mustered enough courage to climb through the bloody muck in the front seat and get out of the van. Mrs. Edith Mitchell removed her shoes and all of her clothing. She jumped, naked and white, like a fluffy marshmallow schoolmarm, from the side of the Kelsey Creek Bridge into Kelsey Creek. It was not a good idea. Mrs. Edith Mitchell did not know how to swim. Beneath the surface of Kelsey Creek, a cluster of walleyes was engaged in the spring spawn. On the other side of the bridge, past the parking lot for Amelia Jinks Bloomer Park, as Robbie drove into the neighborhood where I lived, we saw a television news van that had come all the way from Des Moines. The van was painted with a bold design that said Eyewitness News. The van sat on its side in the middle of the street. The radar antenna had been deployed and was stretched out across the road like a big broken arm. The doors on the Eyewitness News van were left open. We caught quick passing glimpses of a bloody mess inside the vehicle. There was one black high-top Converse basketball shoe sitting in the road beside the tipped-over van. Unstoppable soldiers do not like to be filmed by television news crews from Des Moines. The first Converse Chuck Taylor signature basketball shoes were made in Massachusetts in 1932. In 1932, Chris Sturba's Nightingale Convenience Works manufactured the last Nightingale urinal. That particular urinal, Chris Sturba's final grand porcelain monolith, ended up beneath the ground in an Iowa sanctuary constructed by a madman. Robbie Breeze and I urinated into it together, in Eden. We drove past three houses that were engulfed in flames, and two others that had already burned to the ground. Apparently, the people of Ealing tried to come up with some method for fighting the unstoppable soldiers. Their ideas did not appear to have been effective. There were dozens of dead Iowans, and mere parts of others, scattered like Halloween decorations across yards, on fence posts, and mailboxes, or lying in the streets. Robbie said,
"When we get to your house, we have to get the guns loaded quick. Then we need to go back to the Del Vista Arms."
I said, "Why?"
"My mom," Robbie said. "I have to try to get my mom."
"Oh." Despite Connie Breeze's obvious shortcomings as a single parent, her son, Robert Breeze Jr., was a good boy. Robbie Breeze really was a superhero. I did not even think about my mother and father until Robbie told me he wanted to rescue his mother. My cell phone was with my clothes inside the locker room in Eden. I hoped my parents, and Eric, my brother who had lost half his right leg, and both of his testicles in Afghanistan nearly a week before, were not planning on returning to the continent of North America anytime soon. "You are a superhero or shit like that, Rob," I said.
"A gay superhero," Robbie added.
Robbie blew a big cloud of smoke out from the mouth of his grimacing lemur mask. It was just about the coolest thing I had ever seen. "I just realized that the unstoppable soldier's god is gay," I said.
"I told you I was, in seventh grade," Robbie corrected.
I smiled and nodded. The grimacing lemur mask on my head only grimaced and smoked. "I am sorry, Rob," I said. I squeezed Robbie's hand.
"There's nothing you can do about me being gay," Robbie said.
Readers of history may decide that joking while two guys are driving around through a town that has recently been slaughtered by 6-foot-tall praying mantis beasts with shark-tooth-studded arms is in poor taste. It is. But that is exactly what real boys have always done when confronted with the brutal aftermath of warfare. Dulce et decorum est. I said, "I am going to try to be a better person. Not so selfish and shit. And maybe one day, you will tell me if I have done it."
Let's have another fag before we get out," Robbie said.
He maneuvered the Explorer as close to my garage as he could get it. Then Robbie said,
"And then let's go kill some big fucking bugs, Porcupine."
"I think Benson and Hedges are the right kind of cigarettes to smoke just before you kill something," I said.
There are no cup of noodles in Eden.
Eden's army of grimacing lemurs landed in Ealing, and it was time for them to go to war.
Robbie Breeze and I charged up the paintball guns.
We injected small amounts of Robbie's blood into dozens of grape-sized jellied projectiles.
When we finished, we left three blood-stained hypodermic needles on the white-tiled countertop in my kitchen. It looked like a heroin den. It was disgusting. The smell of blood made me want to vomit. I had been smelling it all day.
We smoked and smoked to cover up the defeated odor that hung everywhere over Ealing, Iowa.
Before we left my house, I grabbed an armload of clean underwear and t-shirts and the razor and shaving cream from my bathroom. Tomorrow would be Saturday. Saturdays were shaving days. I did not take my bottle of bubble bath with me. I would miss taking baths. There had to be a bathtub somewhere in Eden. There were no cup of noodles in Eden, so I also filled a paper sack with as many of the paper and styrofoam containers of the miracle food I could find in the pantry. All houses in Iowa have pantries. Cup of noodles are unstoppable food. Before we left my house, the telephone in the kitchen began ringing and ringing. It was my father calling. He wanted to know what the hell was happening. He wanted to know why the hell I had not called him. And he asked, how the hell did Ealing, Iowa end up on news broadcasts in Germany, telling stories of enormous bugs that were devouring every man, woman, and child in the town? What the hell was all this about?
It is a lot of hell, Dad, I said. At exactly that moment, all the power cut out everywhere in Ealing, Iowa. The wireless phone in our kitchen went dead.
Robbie and I heard gunfire in the distance. Ealing, Iowa had gone to hell. Rat boys from Mars, and an unfortunate incident involving an inflatable whale. Picture this if you can. Robbie Breeze and I, wearing fur-covered, full-head grimacing lemur masks that helped identify unstoppables, smoking cigarettes and dressed in matching form-fitting blue and white Eden Project jumpsuits, as we carried fully automatic paintball rifles slung over our shoulders, and we were accompanied by a 60-pound golden retriever that could not bark. If we had thought everything out more clearly, we probably would have anticipated the likelihood of being fired upon by real guns and real bullets from my next-door neighbors, Earl Elgin and his teenage son, whose name was Earl Elgin Jr. Earl Elgin Jr. was 15 years old, a red-headed Lutheran boy who attended Curtis